Good morning. Welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. I am Amy Johnson, your board rep this morning, and hopefully you're keeping warm in this wonderfully cold morning. We have a variety of announcements in our order of service, so make sure to check them out. A couple of extras to talk to you about today. First of all, is our designated monthly collection. The Social Action Committee's designated monthly collection for January is for the Hebron House, which provides short-term assistance to people experiencing homelessness in Waukesha County, as well as services to assist them in permanent housing. Checks can be made out to LCUUC, with the amount for Hebron House noted on the memo line. We'd also like to talk to you about the Nature Retreat that's coming up on March 1st through the 3rd. Today's the first day for you to start signing up for that, so make sure you do that. It should be fun. We're going to be going up to the North Woods for this opportunity, experiencing nature in lots of different ways. So there'll be some nature guides there, also snowshoeing and hiking and lots of fun things. So check out your order of service for that as well with additional information. And then just a reminder about our new member ceremony on February 3rd. So those of you who are new members or looking to be new members that be interested in joining, please see me or someone else after the service today. I invite you to greet those around you this morning. Say hello.
Hello. Hello. Welcome here. I'll just wave. Is that okay?
They're so friendly. I love that. That's my favorite part of the morning, I think. Say hello to each other. If you are a guest, we welcome you particularly. There is a guest sign-up out in the foyer, so feel free to sign up. There's guest information. We definitely welcome you, and if you're seeking more information, please check out that information or come see me or one of the other members of our church. They'd be happy to tell you more about our church life and answer any questions that you have. If you are here with your children, you are welcome to keep them in the service, or there is some child care right out the door on the left-hand side in the hallway. You can drop them off there if you would like to, or there are RE services for our older children as well. After the story for all ages, then our children proceed out to RE services. Let's see. We also enjoy getting to know our guests, so if there are any guests this morning that would like to be introduced or introduce themselves, we'd be happy to get to know you. No? No takers. Welcome. Welcome. Good to see you. We welcome you anyways. Thank you. Yes. And bless your heart, really. Everybody's invited to gather in the social hall after our service for refreshments and conversation. Please put your cell phones on silence at this time. I hope you find this morning's service warm. Gil Guerrero was scheduled to be with us from Dallas, but he's been sidelined by a sudden illness, so fortunately he wasn't able to join us, but lucky for us, Joanne Dale joins us from Southern Indiana, where she lives on 110 acres with her partner of 34 years. Wow, way to go. And their 16-year-old daughter, as well as assorted furred and feathered creatures. She recently retired from a career as an attorney and now works as a grief counselor and a student at Cherry Hill Seminary. She's been doing beyond categorical thinking work with Unitarian Universalist congregations for the past decade. So we welcome her today. Please enjoy the service.
have a special reflection here, a connection and reflection, as part of our stewardship campaign. So Janica Yoder will share that with us now.
Good morning, everybody. I was recruited, as some of the rest of you were, have been or will be, by our wonderful leader, Barbara Howell, and to tell my story of being a UU. It's interesting. I think probably every single one of us has a story similar to this, so it's fun to sort of get a person's story together. I've been a UU member since LCUUC member since 2004. That would be about 10 years. I was surprised to realize it's been 10 years. I discovered the Unitarian religion almost by accident. It was right before the election of 2004. My daughter Alex, who was then just 16, and I were invited to a pre-election party, presidential election party, with other folks from the Kettle Moraine School District. Many of my daughter's friends were there with their parents. The place was thick with UUs. I met Lynn and Phil Smith there, and as I recall, Phil and I fell into a discussion about a good place to meet like-minded people, and it was the UU Church in Wales. I was totally intrigued by what I heard. Alex, my daughter, wanted to go. We visited and then joined later that year. 2 years later, my daughter went off to college in Chicago, and our little congregation had moved into a new site here, a new home where we now are in Hartford. Not being focused quite so much on my daughter, I found many new reasons to come to church. I've thought about this lately, and it feels to me as though when I established a relationship with this community of UUs, it opened up part of me that needed to be woken up. There is a generosity of spirit here, an intelligence, a grace, a love of nature, and a desire to learn and make beer and have fun, a lot of fun. That is the personality of LCUUC, and it comes from all of you in it. Additionally, and I have to mention this, I don't know what I would have done without my, and these are in capitals, great women friends of this church. You know who you are. During these my post-divorce years, you have all made me stronger by your examples, and I have had so much fun with all of you. LCUUC is my community, and it has helped me grow so much. It has given me the opportunity to do one of the things I love to do best, and that's to be a teacher. It has given me a reason to get up and out on some pretty dark Sunday mornings. It has helped me learn about my own strengths and shortcomings. Through the practices of Unitarian Universalism, I have recognized my own spirituality, searched for it, defined it, and found it in my own front yard. Thank you.
Lay it down. Just lay it down. For we have arrived at this place. Lay down both your suspicions and your certainty. We need no longer clutch tightly at our armor or our calcified rule books or our rigid memories of failures and successes. Lay them all down. Open wide your arms, for at last we have arrived in each other's presence. Welcome. I have been waiting for you. Separately, we have maintained the moments that have been and the bonds that have been. Let us now lay them down and make space and will and time to embrace. Let us build together the moments ahead and then lay them down and move on, enriched but unburdened, always open to the next welcome.
We light our flaming chalice to illuminate the world we seek. In the search for truth, may we be just. In the search for justice, may we be loving. And in loving, may we find peace. Please join in singing the chalice lighting with the words as shown in the order of service. Opening hymn is number 407. We're going to sit at the welcome table. Please stand as you're willing and able. Children or the young at heart want to come up front now would be the time for our story for all ages.
They told me I could sit on the steps here. The problem is with my knees, if I sit down here, you'll have to come haul me up, and nobody wants to see that, so I'm going to stand up here. After you go off to your religious education, we're going to be talking about things that make people unique and how those unique things can be very valuable to themselves and to the community.
And so I wanted to read you a book about, it's called Tacky the Penguin, one of my favorites. There once lived a penguin. His home was a nice, icy land he shared with his companions. His companions were named Goodly, Lovely, Angel, Neatly, and Perfect. His name was Tacky. Tacky was an odd bird. Every day, Goodly, Lovely, Angel, Neatly, and Perfect greeted each other quietly and politely. And Tacky greeted them with a hearty slap on the back and a loud, "Hey, what's happening?" Goodly, Lovely, Angel, Neatly, and Perfect always marched 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Tacky marched 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 3, 6, 0, 2.5, and then he lay down. His companions were graceful divers. Tacky liked to do very splashy cannonballs. Goodly, Lovely, Angel, Neatly, and Perfect always sang pretty songs like Sunrise on the Iceberg. And Tacky always sang songs like How Many Toes Does a Fish Have? Tacky was a very odd bird. One day the penguins heard the thump, thump, thump of feet in the distance. And this could only mean one thing. Hunters were coming. They came with maps and maps and rocks and locks. They were rough and tough. As the thump, thump, thump drew closer, the penguins could hear the growly voices chanting, "We're gonna catch some pretty penguins, and we'll march them with a switch, and we'll sell them for a dollar and get rich, rich, rich." Goodly, Lovely, Angel, Neatly, and Perfect ran away in fright. They hid behind a block of ice. Tacky stood alone. The hunters marched right up to him, chanting, "We're going to catch some pretty penguins. We'll march them with a switch, and we'll sell them for a dollar and get rich, rich, rich." "What's happening?" blared Tacky, giving one hunter an especially hearty slap on the back. They growled, "We're hunting for penguins. That's what's happening." "Penguins?" said Tacky. "You mean those birds that march neatly in a row?" And then he marched. 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 2.5, 0. The hunters looked puzzled. "Do you mean those birds that dive so gracefully?" Tacky asked. And he did a big, splashy cannonball, and the hunters looked wet. "Do you mean those birds that sing such pretty songs?" And then Tacky began to sing, and from behind the block of ice came the voices of his companions, all singing as loudly and dreadfully as they could. "How many toes does a fish have, and how many wings on a cow? I wonder, yup, I wonder." The hunters could not stand the horrible singing. This could not be the land of the pretty penguins. They ran away with their hands clasped tightly over their ears, leaving behind their maps and traps and rocks and locks, and not looking at all rough and tough. Goodly, Lovely, Angel, Neatly, and Perfect hugged Tacky. Tacky was an odd bird, but a very nice bird to have around.
Was made by the cookie man, and on my way.
Thank you, Doug. And now it's time for our joys and concerns. Special time we take each week to reflect on our deep concerns or special joys that would like to share. And so please state your name and the microphone will be passed and share that with us. I'll light our memorial candle to start. And today, I think, in light of all the poor health that some people are having, one of our speakers, for example, I'm going to light the memorial candle that we treasure the good health when we have it and think about those who don't have it at the moment.
Hello, this is Phil. We have two candles for joy. Richie's birthday is Monday, and Jenna's is Tuesday this week. So.
I'm Eric. A candle, I guess, let's say a candle for joy that we survived the week. Two of us having flu. Bjorn was the lead in the play and had the flu but managed to get through it. And Sue broke her wrist but is recovering and on to next week.
Hi, this is Tammy. I'd like to light a candle of joy for two reasons. First of all, my father is turning 90 years old on Tuesday. He's still in great health, drives cars and everything else. And my mother was in the hospital again recently and is now out of the hospital and doing fine.
This is Leanne. I just want to light a candle of courage for my mother, who's transitioning into an assisted living place, and for my sister, who a candle of rest and peace, who has worked really hard to find that for her.
Hi, my name is Kirsten. If you could light a candle of support for my daughter, Claire, her longtime horse companion of 20 years, she had to put down last week.
This is Lynn, a candle of concern for one of our members, Kristen Sandin, who had some major surgery this week. She's doing well and recovering well. And please, a candle of joy. Our world religions class through church here went to the Hindu temple yesterday and spent 4 hours learning and interacting with the Hindus there. It was really a wonderful experience.
This is Al. Two candles. You can put them in one, though. Generally a candle of concern for visitors to our church. Not only are they confronted by beer in a testimonial, but apparently Clark Brewer showed up in garb today. A candle of joy for our membership for the transformation that perhaps we'll see stewardship man.
I'm Randy. A candle of joy and appreciation for all the positive cards, calls, and good wishes since this crazy heart attack came, 2 hospitalizations and 6 stents later, kind of gives you a new appreciation for life. And it makes me feel good that I'm part of this group.
And I'll light one last candle for the joys and concerns we keep in our heart today. Was there one more? Oh, go ahead.
Hi, it's Barb. Please light a candle of hope for our country as we inaugurate our president. Actually, I think it might be happening right now in Washington, that we may learn to come together and work on our differences.
Now I'll light that one last candle for the joys and concerns we keep in our hearts today.
we each have our own ways of connecting with our own sense of ultimate meaning. Some may recite well-worn phrases. Some may speak to a divine as though it were a friend. And some may reach out to pluck a string in the interdependent web. What I'd like for us to do today is to think about what makes us unique, each of us. These joys and concerns are matters of uniqueness to the individuals that have shared them. What's unique about you? Telling by Laura Hershey. What you risk telling your story. You will bore them. Your voice will break. Your ink will spill and stain your coat. No one will understand. Their eyes become fences. You will park yourself forever on the outside. Your differentness once and for all revealed. Dangerous. The names you give to yourself will become epithets. Your happiness will be called bravery, denial. Your sadness will justify their pity. Your fear will magnify their fears. Everything you say will prove something about their God or their economic system. Your feelings that change day to day, kaleidoscopic, will freeze in place. Brand you forever, justify anything they decide to do with you. Those with power can afford to tell their story or not. Those without power risk everything to tell their story and must. Someone, somewhere, will hear your story and decide to fight, to live, and refuse compromise. Someone else will tell her own story, risking everything once again.
In Gil's absence, I do have the reading that he was going to use, so I'll share that with you. The reading is from The Teachings of Don Juan, A Yaqui Way of Knowledge by Carlos Castaneda. And for those unfamiliar with this work, Carlos Castaneda was an anthropology student at UCLA who met a Yaqui, which would not be Yankee, but Yaqui in Mexico, shaman from Sonora, Mexico. Don Juan Matas ultimately became his mentor in learning Yaqui sorcery. So it's sort of a question and answer format. Starts with, what is a man of knowledge? A man of knowledge is one who followed truthfully the hardships of learning, a man who has, without rushing or without faltering, gone as far as he can in unraveling the secrets of power and knowledge. Can anyone be a man of knowledge? No, not anyone. Then what must a man do to become a man of knowledge? He must challenge and defeat his four natural enemies. Anyone can try to become a man of knowledge. Very few men actually succeed, but that is only natural. The enemies a man encounters on the path to learning to become a man of knowledge are truly formidable. Most men succumb to them. When a man starts to learn, he is never clear about his objectives. His purpose is faulty, his intent is vague. He hopes for rewards that will never materialize, for he knows nothing of the hardships of learning. He slowly begins to learn, bit by bit at first, then in big chunks, and his thoughts soon clash. What he learns is never what he pictured or imagined, and so he begins to be afraid. Learning is never what one expects. Every step of learning is a new task, and the fear the man is experiencing begins to mount mercilessly, unyieldingly. His purpose becomes a battlefield. And thus, he has stumbled upon the first of his natural enemies, fear, a terrible enemy, treacherous and difficult to overcome. It remains concealed at every turn, prowling, waiting. And if the man, terrified in its presence, runs away, his enemy will have put an end to his quest. What will happen to the man if he runs away in fear? Nothing happens to him except that he will never learn. He will never become a man of knowledge. And what can he do to overcome fear? The answer is very simple. He must not run away. He must defy his fear and, in spite of it, must take the next step in learning, and the next, and the next. He must be fully afraid, and yet he must not stop. And a moment will come when his first enemy retreats. Once a man has vanquished fear, he's free from it for the rest of his life because he has acquired clarity, a clarity of mind which erases fear. He can anticipate the new steps of learning, and a sharp clarity surrounds everything. The man feels that nothing is concealed. And thus he has encountered his second enemy, clarity. That clarity of mind, which is so hard to obtain, dispels fear, but it also blinds. It forces the man never to doubt himself. It gives him the assurance he can do anything that he pleases, for he sees clearly into everything. And he's courageous because he's clear, and he stops at nothing because he is clear. But all that is a mistake. It is like something incomplete. If the man yields to this make-believe power, he has succumbed to his second enemy and will be patient when he should rush. And he will fumble with learning until he winds up incapable of learning anything more. His second enemy has just stopped him cold from trying to become a man of knowledge. Instead, the man may turn into a buoyant warrior or a clown. He will be clear as long as he lives, but he will no longer learn or yearn for anything. But what does he have to do to avoid being defeated? He must do what he did with fear. He must defy his clarity and use it only to see, and wait patiently and measure carefully before taking new steps. He must think, above all, that his clarity is almost a mistake. And a moment will when he will understand that his clarity was only a point before his eyes, and thus he will have overcome his second enemy and will arrive at a position where nothing can harm him anymore. This will not be a mistake. It will not be only a point before his eyes. It will be true power. He will know at this point that the power he has been pursuing for so long is finally his. His ally is at his command. But he has also come across his third enemy, power. Power is the strongest of all enemies, and naturally the easiest thing to do is to give in. After all, the man is truly invincible. He commands because he is a master. A man at this stage hardly notices his third enemy is closing in on him, and suddenly, without knowing, he will certainly have lost the battle. His enemy will have turned him into a cruel, capricious man. A man who is defeated by power dies without really knowing how to handle it. Power is only a burden upon his fate. Such a man has no command over himself and cannot tell when or how to use his power. How can he defeat his third enemy, Don Juan? He has to defy it deliberately. He has to come to realize the power he has seemingly conquered is in reality never his. If he can see that clarity and power, without his control over himself, are worse than mistakes, he will reach a point where everything is held in check. He will know then when and how to use his power, and thus he will have defeated his third enemy. The man will be, by then, at the end of his journey of learning, and almost without warning, he will come upon the last of his enemies, old age. This enemy is the cruelest of all, the one he won't be able to defeat completely, but only fight away. This is the time when a man has no more fears, no more impatient clarity of mind, but also the time when he has an unyielding desire to rest. If he gives in totally to his desire to lie down and forget, if he soothes himself in tiredness, he will have lost this last round. But if the man sloughs off his tiredness and lives his fate through, he can be called a man of knowledge, if only for a brief moment when he succeeds in fighting off his last invincible enemy. That moment of clarity, power, and knowledge is enough. Now please join us in our hymn, number 128, For All That Is Our Life.
one of the reasons why when we do these beyond categorical thinking services and workshops, we always have two facilitators is because it's always wonderful to see how individual stories mesh and how they differ. So unfortunately, you're either going to have to imagine half of the time that I am a Latino man presenting as male and half the time an Anglo woman presenting as female, or you're going to have to look within yourself and see what is unique about you. Another advantage of having two presenters is that we have a different view of readings and so on. And that's why Gil was kind enough to send us the reading that he would have done as part of his message. And John has shared that with us. As for me, I attend church and I do most of my work in an urban setting, but my home life is very rural. And I've sometimes fantasized about creating a handbook for people like me who suffer from cultural dissociative disorder. I could include things like what to do upon first realizing that I've tracked goose poop into the minister's study, or how not to sound as though I'm in a grief counseling session when I'm actually at a farm equipment auction, or vice versa. But of course, I don't actually have a divided self. Just like all of us, I'm one complex person. And like all of us, I have to harmonize within myself all of the different faces that people think they see when they look at me. And sometimes the process is hard. Like at my father's funeral, when I discovered at the last minute that my partner had been omitted from the family seating area, and I was forced to choose between supporting my mother or having the support of my spouse. Or when my brother told me that I was not welcome in his house because of my lifestyle, and I actually had to stop and think for a minute whether he was talking about my being a lawyer. Or having a same-sex partner. Or when we toured the hospital before my partner gave birth to our daughter, and we heard the nurse say that only the father of the baby could enter the nursery. Well, Carol is not shy, and she immediately spoke up and said, "The father of our baby is an anonymous donor. Are you saying that her other mother can't go into the nursery and get our child?" The smiling nurse assured us that, yes, that was in fact the case. Oh, what to do? Should I put on the crusading activist hat? The efficient lawyer hat? One chooses one's battles, and in the end, I decided to save my energy for a battle that was more than merely symbolic. I just put on my happy parent-to-be hat and went on with the tour. But mostly, I wondered why I should have to choose among my different selves instead of living the one life that is my truth. When I think about things like this, I'm reminded of something that Sandra Cisneros wrote. It's called 11. What they don't understand about birthdays and what they never tell you is that when you're 11, you're also 10 and 9 and 8 and 7 and 6 and 5 and 4 and 3 and 2 and 1. And when you wake up on your 11th birthday, you expect to feel 11, but you don't. You open your eyes and everything's just like yesterday, only it's today. And you don't feel 11 at all. You feel like you're still 10. And you are, underneath the year that makes you 11. Like some days you might say something stupid, and that's the part of you that's still 10. Or maybe some days you might need to sit on your mother's lap because you're scared. That's the part of you that's 5. And maybe one day when you're all grown up, maybe you'll need to cry like you're 3. And that's okay. That's what I tell Mama when she's sad and needs to cry. Maybe she's feeling 3. Because the way you grow old is kind of like an onion, or like the rings inside a tree trunk. Or like my little wooden dolls that fit one inside the other each year inside the next. That's how being 11 years old is. You don't feel 11, not right away. It takes a few days, weeks even, sometimes even months before you say 11 right away when they ask you. And you don't feel smart 11, not until you're almost 12. And that's the way it is. So when I'm trying to integrate my apparently different lives into the reality of my one whole life, I think about the way good fiction writers say they create characters. They've lived with them. They know them. They know a great deal more about the character than they ever tell us. When characters are drawn like this, when they're imagined in their wholeness, we like them. We describe them as real or multifaceted or believable. It is, in fact, their complexity, their multiplicity, their richness that appeals to us. We like to see real characteristics all nested one inside the other. If the main character happens to be vegetarian or happens to be left-handed or happens to hail from Missouri, that's part of a full, believable character. And yet, there are some characteristics that we trip over, categories that keep us from seeing the fullness of the characters. Consider this. If the main character happens to be a recovering alcoholic, or happens to be Latina, or happens to be a trans woman, we think that aspect is the most important thing about the character. And we have confidence that that aspect will be an important part of the story. In the same way, if we're not told that the central character is transgender, we assume that her gender identity matches her genetic sex. And sadly, we also do it with real people. If we learn that someone is a gay man, or is African American, or is taking medication for bipolar disorder, we often let the person's wholeness be consumed in our minds by that one detail. We notice and magnify any behavior that fits our image of that characteristic, and we filter out all the behavior that conflicts with our image. This sort of selective thinking, filtering, limits our ability to see each other in all our marvelous complexity. There's a peculiar paradox that works like this. If you tell me you are bisexual or Christian or challenged by depression or libertarian or of Iraqi descent, you've taken an important step in trusting me enough to bring a part of yourself out in the open. But in fact, you've really told me very little about who you are, because you are so much more than that. So if I then make assumptions based on that one characteristic, then even though you've shared a part of yourself, possibly a very important part, I still won't be seeing you in your wholeness. I'll be blinded by the ways you're different from me, or by my experience with one or two other people who happen to share that one characteristic with you. As soon as I put you into a category, I filter my experience with you so that the things that fit my image of that category are magnified in my mind, and the things that don't fit are filtered out of my awareness. And furthermore, when I drop you into a category, I've separated you from others, and I've already begun treating you differently. My partner has multiple sclerosis. Sometimes she walks unaided. Sometimes she uses a cane. Sometimes she uses a mobility scooter or a chair. She is always the same witty, creative, caring person. But even people who know her tend to treat her differently when she's in a wheelchair. And to people who don't know her, she can become completely invisible. Once Carol wheeled into a restaurant just ahead of me and our daughter, the host looked right past her and asked me, "How many?" Well, as I've mentioned, she's not timid. And she spoke up and said that there were three of us, whereupon the host again looked past her and asked me, "Inside or on the terrace?" He had placed her into his category of disabled and was much more comfortable dealing with a normal person. Imagine me being considered the normal person. But you see, categories are very powerful. And all of us, at some point, can claim membership in a dominant class and a subordinate class. These classes are not just matters of race or gender identity. These classes are things like adult versus child, or native-born versus newcomer, or varsity versus wannabe, or any number of other things. All of us are simultaneously members of several categories. Diabetic, youngest child, food stamp recipient, born on the East Coast, unemployed parent, caregiver for an aging parent. And then we remember Sandra Cisneros' description of birthdays and how all of the things that we have been are nested inside what we are. And the list of our categories is astounding. So when we talk about being limited by categorical thinking, we mean taking just a few categories and treating them differently from all others. Now, being limited by categorical thinking during a ministerial search is particularly unfortunate for a congregation and its individual members. Because, you see, searching takes three steps. First, the search committee helps us figure out who we are, what the congregation considers the most important aspects of ministry in this particular place at this particular time. Second, the search committee helps us figure out what skills and talents the congregation already has that can be built upon rather than duplicated. And finally, the search committee looks for the professional minister who best fills the holes in the ministry that's been identified. The best fit for the congregation. Now, we as congregants often overlook the fact that the first two steps, the ones that require knowing ourselves, are far more important than the third. A search committee that does what yours is in the process of doing, facilitating your seeing who you are as a congregation, where you want to go, what additional skills you need to get there, that search committee is an unmitigated success without regard to whether it even locates a candidate and presents him or her to the congregation. Once the search committee crafts a mirror and convinces us to look into it, much of the heavy lifting is done. So when we speak of categorical thinking, are we talking about stereotyping? Well, that's part of it. We all use stereotypes at times as shortcuts, a sort of introductory summary or cheat sheet, as in Unitarian Universalists are questioners, or Asian students are hardworking. The process is not necessarily evil in itself, but the temptation is to stop with that Cliff Notes version of groups and fail to see the individual. When we take the stereotype not only as true, but as an adequate description of any member of the group, we make people shallow and unreal. Of course, we as UUs tend to think, well, thank goodness my congregation welcomes everyone, and none of us harbors hostility toward groups based on age or size or sexual orientation or disability or color. But the most important thing about the insidious process of categorical thinking, selective filtering, making assumptions about individual people because of a particular characteristic, is this: it does not require any ill will. We can't avoid it simply by saying, I don't hate anybody, because it's there. It's in our very being. I was listening on the drive up here to this year's Common Read, The New Jim Crow, which I highly recommend. It's a very important book. And I was listening to a portion of the book that talked about an experiment that used a video game. This was done many times over several years. The subject is given a gun and is presented with rapidly presented images of a figure who's holding something. And sometimes what that figure is holding is a gun. Sometimes it's a pop can or a wallet or something else. And sometimes the figure is white, and sometimes the figure is dark. And what they found was the number of mistakes made was much greater. The number of times when someone was perceived as a threat was much greater if the figure was dark. And the number of mistakes made in perceiving that the figure was not a threat was much greater. The figure was white. It's the same across all groups in society. And here's the scary part. It's also true even when the subject is a person of color. So it's just in our very air that we breathe. So the only way that we can do this stuff is to really try to bring it to consciousness. We don't do categorical thinking work because we imagine that any congregation consciously chooses to discriminate on the basis of affectional preference or gender expression or race or perceived disability. We do it because we know we can all always improve our capacity for seeing each other as whole human beings. We can always do a little better job of respecting inherent worth and dignity. Beyond categorical thinking, facilitators do not have the magic answer. A story that Gil would have told you if he had been here concerns a Hasidic congregation that was wandering lost in the forest, and they could not find their way out, and they were just overjoyed when they stumbled upon their rabbi, who was also in the forest, and they said, Rabbi, help us find the answer. How do we get out of here? And the rabbi said, I can tell you a lot of paths that don't lead out of the forest, and then we can work together to find one that does. We don't get past categorical thinking by pretending some characteristic doesn't exist. There's great power in naming, and some categories have to be called out by name before they lose their hold. Until we can be open with ourselves and with each other, until we can wrestle with our own fears and honestly voice our own assumptions or those we believe others hold. That is, until we can allow ourselves to be vulnerable. Categories are going to remain intact. We're going to be going down the same paths that don't lead out of the forest. And we will miss the chance for relationships to flourish. There's an old Buddhist story about an impatient student who asked what one could do to bring about his or her own enlightenment. The master answered, "Just as little as you can do to make the sun rise in the morning." Well, the student was puzzled and asked, "Then of what use is religion and spiritual practice?" And the master replied, "To make sure you are not asleep when the sun begins to rise." A congregation in ministerial search is hoping for a sunrise. And there are practices that can help us be awake when the sun begins to come up. We can recognize the drawbacks inherent in categories. We can remind ourselves that assumptions do harm, regardless of intention. And there's one more. When I look at you, I don't see you through the eyes of a native Texan, or the eyes of a bisexual person, or the eyes of an overweight older woman. I just see you through the eyes of the person I am. And in the end, my most challenging and rewarding practice will be to see into your eyes, past your many faces and categories, to see you as the one whole person you are. It's tough stuff, but can anybody doubt it's worth it?
So now it's time for our morning offering, and the greeters will pass the baskets. Although many of us choose to make our main financial contributions through regular electronic bank transactions, it's still an ever-present reminder that our church is funded completely through the generosity of you, the congregation. May this time be another small step on the way to achieving our long-term goals. If you're visiting us today, please consider yourself our guest and feel no obligation to contribute. And as was mentioned earlier, this monthly designated collection is for the Hebron House of Hospitality, so the loose cash donations will go to Hebron House, and checks can be made out to LCUC and with amounts specified for Hebron House and for LCUC noted on the memo line. have a congregational affirmation this morning. It's number 657. I'll read the standard type, and if you would read the italics, that would be great. It matters what we believe. Some beliefs are like walled gardens. They encourage exclusiveness and the feeling of being especially privileged. Some beliefs are like shadows, clouding children's days with fears of unknown calamities. Some beliefs are divisive, separating the saved from the unsaved, friends from enemies. Some beliefs are like blinders, shutting off the power to choose one's own direction. Some beliefs weaken a person's selfhood. They blight the growth of resourcefulness. Some beliefs are rigid, like the body of death, impotent in a changing world. Our closing hymn is number 1008. That would be in the teal hymnal, When Our Heart Is in a Holy Place.
Here in community, may you know that you are loved and that you are lovable. If here you have found peace, or inspiration, embrace them and carry them with you into the world as a blessing.